You are listening to The Night War, an audio companion. For more than 65 years, the Night War has taught us what it takes to fight a war, and what war takes from those who fight. In a few moments, we'll return to February 1944 and the Howling Commandos' daring assault on the Greek island of Hydra. Before we get started, though, we get to share an interview with a very special guest.
Righto. So, as we mentioned last time, I got to go all the way to Long Island to meet Mr. Frank Castellano himself. He was one of Bucky's best friends, and they fought in the war together. And I've got some great audio for you guys.
Okay, take it away.
Hey guys, this is Olivia Barnes, reporting for The Night War, an audio companion. I'm here in Staff Sergeant Frank Castellano's house for a short interview with the man himself.
You nailed it, kid.
Thanks. So, thank you for having me here, sir, and thank you for supporting the podcast.
First of all, none of that god-awful sir bullshit stuff. I don't work for a living.
Alright, you got it, Frank.
Alright then. And second, it's not me doing anything, it's a charity.
The Able to Help Foundation.
Right. One of the things that came out of that book is that suddenly a whole mess of folks thought a pack of rough and tumble GIs might have something interesting to say, all because we were Sarge's pals.
So, people were trying to interview you? Like, even way back then?
Yeah, even back in the days of dinosaurs and pyramids.
And, what did they ask you about?
Well, thing is, it was only newspapers calling every so often, when it was the anniversary or this or that. Is this the Mr. Frank Castellano who served with Bucky Barnes in the war? Yes, it is, and with a hell of a lot of other good men, too. And do you have any comment to make on the 10th anniversary of VE Day? No? How about the 15th? The 20th?
but people still wanted to know.
Right. And the thing was, there weren't a lot of able company men who made it home. Just about 24 who made it through the camp. And then after the war, I tried to track down all the rest who had injuries and so on, and ended up with about 50 names.
Oh, wow.
Right, just 50 out of about 150. So I suppose I took it on myself a bit to try and keep in touch with all the fellas. Started putting on dinners and get-togethers and stuff.
When was that?
Well, it was a Frank and Joe special, if I'm honest. Joe Fortunato. He's as much of a gossip as I am. Anyhow, we put on the first little reunion in, it must have been the fall of 48, 5 years after the camp.
Why then?
Well, some time goes by. Everybody getting hitched, having kids, working.
What did you do?
Christ, he's bad as my own granddaughter. Can't let an old man finish his story. I was a plumber. Master plumber of the United Association Local Number 1 Union. And you leave that in the tape, Missy.
I will.
Anyhow, as fellas are living their lives, it's easy to lose touch. And that's what happened. In our platoon, we had a fella by the name of Chet. Chester Chernowitz.
He's in the book.
I'll take your word for it. Anyhow, Chet, well, he had a real tough time after the war. A real tough time. He lost his, well, he had a very close friend who died. Got killed. And after the camp, he got discharged, got sent back home. His war was over. Only, I think...
What?
Well, it wasn't as a thing. I think sometimes there are boys who, for one reason or another, whether what they've seen or done, it don't leave them. Some boys can move on, put it in a box, that's what I did. Came home, wrote letters to my friends, married my best girl, had a couple of rugrats, and the war stayed in the war. I was lucky.
What happened?
Well, Chet never came to any of our little reunions, stopped answering letters, and I'll be honest, we didn't go looking, not for any kind of awful reason, just out of sight, out of mind, I suppose. Can't force a man to talk old war stories, bring up all that awful all over again. And it was, well, 1962, I suppose, because that's the year before we founded the charity. Anyhow, Chet passed away. Car accident. Drunk. His family hadn't seen him in years. Just, geez, he was only 40? Just 40 years old.
That's so sad.
It is. and it made the news on account of his name popping up in that damn book. And there's only so many Chester Chernowitzes in the world. Got a call. Did I know about him? What was he like? Had he been a coward? Had he taken his own life, did I suppose? There was another young man in a car with him, and, well, anyway. And everybody's so interested in what his old platoon mates thought. Everybody was so concerned. So it occurred to us, me and Joe, we didn't just want to be in the news when a friend of ours died. We didn't want folks to only start giving a damn when it was too late. If we was going to be, what's the word, celebrities, on account of that book, we might as well do something with it. We might as well help if we could.
We can help.
So we do, that's right. We thought, well, what's a way to keep families together? What's a way to use the fact that there are folks who think I got something new to say about Buck, about Sarge, even 20 years after the fact, even 50, in a way that might do some good for the world? And so me and Joe, and then Gene Plinsky, Jimmy Delaney, and another pal of ours, Woody Doyle, Whitford, he passed in 04, we got ourselves a plan put together, and we decided to take the idea Able Company and make it into something new, something that didn't just get blown up in Vanafro.
And since then?
Set up in 1963, still going strong, 50 years later. We've sent, I have the number here somewhere, but I think it's something like 16,000 kids to summer camp. And last year, our 1,000th Able Fellow, that's our scholarship program, graduated college. She's in law school now. By 1970, I do believe every single member of Able Company was involved in some way or another. We didn't have any more Chesters, that's for sure. And we got to do a bit of good.
What made you decide to help support our podcast project?
Well, nobody ever took me for a fool, Missy. I know a good marketing opportunity when I see one. And besides that, your great Annie called me up, and I ain't never been able to say no to her.
Nobody can.
For damn sure.
Okay, so, I have just a couple more questions.
Let's hear them.
Okay, some of these are questions we got from listeners on the podcast. The first one is, let's see. Do you have a book about Able Company or the Howling Commandos that you think is the best one?
I haven't read many, but I am partial to a company of men such as ours. Little Harry wrote it, Harry Miller's son. He's a historian. Practically set up a camp bed in my living room for about a year when he was working on it.
I haven't read that one, but is the title...
It comes from, well, it came from one of Sarge's letters that he sent me near the end of the war. I got it, but it didn't reach me until after he was killed. Anyhow, he had a way with words, if he put his mind to it. But I haven't read much else, I'm afraid.
Okay, and this is another question. Here it is. Is there anything you can tell us about the real Bucky Barnes?
Oh, God. Not much fit for little girls to hear.
Hey!
All right. Well, here's something I don't know was in your book. Sarge was just about the stubbornest asshole whoever put on the uniform. God, oh, fucking mighty. Oh, and him and his smoke rings.
Huh?
Smoke rings. You know, you exhale smoke, so it's in a circle. He was always a little too proud of that, in my opinion.
Can you do that?
No, I cannot. Ask my doctor. I don't smoke anymore.
But you...
There's a radio program, isn't it? What they can't see, they can't prove. You got any other questions, Missy?
Only about a million. But that's it for today. Thank you, Frank.
It was my genuine pleasure, sweetheart.
February 2nd. The situation here is not like anything I have seen before. In Sicily, I think the war was too new for it to impact the civilians more than just in battle terms. And in Italy, we were not far off the line enough to know how badly off the civs were. But here, it is horrible. We have made contact with several SOE assets. This small island has only about 400 people left who are free, most of them the very old or sick, plus women and children. The Hydra base here has imprisoned the rest for work. The name of our contact is A, and he cannot be more than 16 or 17, but he is as determined as Steve. He has connected us with his pals who can radio back to London, and so have reported our safe arrival. They are not especially impressed at the seven of us, I think, but nonetheless, when A's grandma, or at least an old lady who was hiding him in her root cellar, met us, she tried to feed us. This woman who has not eaten anything more than old vegetables in months. We instead shared some rations with her. Might as well, in any case, as they don't seem to do me any good.
Had to punch a new hole in my belt last week. The plan tomorrow night is for Dernier and Falsworth to coordinate with the partisans to work explosives around what we are calling Top Hat. Thank God for having Steve around to haul heavy things, because I thought Dernier had to be joking when he showed us the creative equipment he was planning on bringing with us. I gave him a little shit about it, too, saying, "Hey, Steve, you know we are going to be waist-deep in water climbing a beachhead, don't you?" And he just grinned, and sure enough, he had no problems at all. Just balanced the thing on his shoulder and got to the beach before the rest of us. It is the most amazing thing I have ever seen. Everything Steve and I used to dream about when we were kids, and thought his sickliness would be something he got over somehow. Anyhow, Dernier seems to have brought every stick of TNT on the British Isles with us. And seeing the state of people here, frankly, I cannot wait for us to light up these Hydra fuckers with it. I am going to be doing a bit of scouting while Steve, Dugan, Jones, and Morda stay hidden. Unfortunately, all four of them will stand out far too much to go out in daylight, whereas I can manage it, either on account of my dark hair or perhaps that I'm nearly as skinny as these poor bastards. Steve put up a good fight until I pointed him at all the photographs Mrs. M. had in her little house and said, "Steve, tell me which of these you could pass for." And he finally gave it up, although he doesn't like it. Of course he doesn't. He never could stand to let other people go it alone. February 3rd. As Falsworth says, the stage is set. Oldest partisan here is our friend A. The rest are boys. They are all determined as hell, however, and knowing that it is their fathers and brothers who may be dying inside Top Hat, and their mothers and sisters starving out of it, it is easy to understand why. I have gotten Jones and Morda to help me give them a bit of weapons training, as none of them have ever seen men who look like them before, so they pay good attention, especially when Jones speaks a little Greek, as he is a dab hand with languages. He was even away at college before enlisting, and to think a fellow like him was made into a quartermaster is a damn shame, especially seeing as you can count on him the same as the rest of us. He does his duty as well as any man I serve with in Able. Eating rations today, he was telling me about where he was trained, somewhere in Georgia, and how there were three colored soldiers who were arrested after getting attacked by a couple of yokels. They got accused of making eyes at a white dame, and the local police held them for days before the army did anything. Meanwhile, one of the fellas got beat so bad in jail he lost his sight in one eye and was discharged. To think that could have been Jones if he'd simply been in the wrong place makes me ill. Anyhow, I do know the fight Steve had to have about having Jones in our unit at all. It did not worry me at the time, as I don't think Steve has ever lost a battle of words in his life. Sharpest tongue in Brooklyn, outside of Curly, probably. But thinking now, I imagine how Jones must have felt. How unrighteous to be asking to fight, and to be said you aren't fit on account of your color. The plan tonight is for Dernier and the boys to take their places while Steve and me take point, and Dugan, Jones, and Morda take the flank. I was able to produce some maps that Mrs. M. improved, seeing as Top Hat used to be a public property, and she remembers it pretty well. Even with our preparations, I am nervous. It can always go wrong. In Italy, although Carter was always complaining about the plan failing, and Harry said once, "Carter, just expect the opposite of what you want to happen and plan for that." And Aldo went, "And what if the opposite of what I want to happen doesn't happen?" And Harry goes, "Then somebody call Ike. You're the luckiest bastard in Italy, and you're now in command of Fifth Army." February 6th. The awful part of all of this is that even though we were successful, and even though we have 50 of those bastards chained up waiting for the Navy task group to send a ride our way, and none of the boys got seriously hurt, and all the rest of this Top Hat op that went well, we are still leaving these people where the fucking Krauts have burned through their fields and food and with no end in sight of it all. Red Cross is having a devil of a time helping in Greece at all, especially in remote places like this island. And there is no guarantee at all that even though we have destroyed Top Hat, that these people will survive the war. We have helped free them a little, but it is terrible to think that their end may still be the same. To die free is still to die. I also thought somehow that because these Krauts were Hydra Krauts, that it would feel different, sharpshooting them, that perhaps I wouldn't feel as sick about it, or something. But I don't know that it has changed at all. Is that better or worse? Part of me thinks I shouldn't give a damn, that if I cared at all about Harry and Lipsy, that I would be goddamn delighted to do it. But when you are in the middle of battle and it's a fight for your life, you don't have the time to think about anything. When I have my eye to my scope, and I am calming my breathing, thinking is all I have.
It takes away the fight and the fear, and instead there's no choice but to confront the fact that you are going to end the life. And they are Hydra Krauts, and God knows every single one of them can go to hell. But the thing is, never in my entire life did I want to be somebody who could send him there. February 9th. Back in Grosvenor Street, as Monty says. Debriefs over. Hours and hours of them. And thank God, as I was so fucking hungry, I was fantasizing smashing the wax typewriter just to get out of there. Informed that it will take at least a few weeks to process all the intel we recovered, and interview the guests. Haven't been a guest in the other direction, and had several interviews. I would rather not imagine how that will go. Morita and I have put in a letter to see if somehow some aid can get to the island, but they told us that even if our request is approved, it's doubtful we will know about it. I have written down their names with Monty's help. I have classical Greek, Barnes, not modern Greek, but I shall endeavor to assist. Who talks like that? And I am resolved to try to look them up after the war. Mrs. M. especially. She would have been great friends with Vini, I think. Anyhow, we have a few days R&R. I want to eat, sleep, and get roaring drunk for all of it. Dugan is making a competition out of it, and winning, as he started drinking on our transport home. Me and Jones determined to catch up. February 11th. Mail. Margaret Miller wrote. When I saw it was from her, the letter in my hand felt suddenly like it weighed 100 pounds. It was not very long. The babies are named Harold Jr. and George, after Harry's father. They are healthy, and they were born on November 24th. She got the notice about Harry on December 3rd, after the news about the rescue of the 107th at Azano hit the papers. I feel so wretched I could weep. In the letter, she writes that she does not blame me, or anyone other than the enemy, and no one from Harry what a fine lady she is, and is not a surprise to read that. But it still does not feel like I wish absolution would. She also wrote, if you do know what Harry's last moments were like, please do write and tell me, even if you worry that I'll find it painful. The not knowing, and my awful imagination, makes every moment I spend thinking of him almost unbearable. My worst fears somehow creep in, even when I think of our best times together. What can a man say to that? I know she must be desperately hoping that he died at once, that he did not know it was the end, and then he experienced no pain. But that is not what happened. The truth is that he suffered. Harry suffered, and he was frightened, and there was nothing anyone at all could do to help him. I could not help him. And I know this is the same end that millions have gotten in this war. I know it is the same end that I may face, or even Steve. God forbid. I had better be gone already, otherwise I couldn't stand it. And perhaps it is selfish of me, but I think I would rather die than tell her what happened. The nature of his death might be common in this new day and age, and what an awful thought. But I know that for myself, watching Harry die is the most awful thing I have ever seen, and the most awful thing I have ever felt. And for his Margaret, how cruel could I be to even think of telling her the truth? If there is one thing I have never wanted in my life, it's to be cruel. At the same time, I think of Steve and his dad, and also Henry O'Halloran and his dad, and how Steve's dad died at Muse. And Steve was in the same situation as little Harry and George are now, born only a couple of months before. O'Halloran was a little older, I suppose, but his dad died too, only he never knew where or anything, just that it was in the war. I never asked him, but I figure he must have always wondered. I don't know if it's the same. After all, little Harry and George will know that it was at Venafro, and that their father was one hell of a soldier, and one of the finest men I ever knew. I will tell them so myself. That's not the same as what Margaret is asking. What kind of a world is it that these are the questions a man must wrestle with? To deny a widow her only request, or to devastate her by honoring it? February 14th. Yesterday, from a Red Cross girl, I heard about a Valentine's Day charity for war orphans and told Steve about it. And so today we decided to go, and Dugan came along too. Anyhow, it turns out it was specially for young girls, not a single one of them older than Curly, and the idea was to raise money and clothing for them. Well, Steve's famous as goddamn Clark Gable, And word spreads fast around London, I guess, because within half an hour of us arriving, the place was a real bonanza. But I have to say, it was maybe the best Valentine's Day I ever had, and that counts 1940 in Dottie. There was a swell band, but when we got there, it was just everybody all standing around, so I went up to them and asked if they knew In the Mood. Sure enough, they did, so I went straight over to the pack of girls, and a very pale and sad lot they looked, no wonder, and with my cap in hand, picked one and said, "Miss, would you care to dance?" Their faces. Never saw somebody's face go so red so fast. Anyway, she collected herself and said to me, "Without even knowing your name? I don't think so." And I laughed and said, "Well, miss, I am Staff Sergeant James Barnes of the United States Army." And she grinned and said, "There's no one here to introduce us." And poked at a friend of hers, even smaller than she was. And her little friend, in her tiny voice, said, "May I introduce Miss Susan Clemens?" So I bowed a bit and offered my arm, and little Susan took it. She can't have been more than 10 years old, and here she was schooling me on manners. But the minute we got on the dance floor, she leans in and says, so seriously, "Sergeant Barnes, I'm afraid I don't know how to dance to this." And I told her, "Don't worry about it, doll. I've got you." And she burst into the most joyful smile I ever saw. Well, I swung her around a bit, just like I used to do with Curly, and that got everyone else in the mood, too. Ha. Huh. And the band could really play. Steve had Dugan run over to the Red Cross Club a few streets over to collect a few more GIs. And so after a while we had a whole pack of doughboys, what the girls called us, dancing with each other and with these girls. And I honestly do think it ended up being more fun than anyone would ever imagine an event for war orphans could be. And Steve's got 2 left feet, but even still, he was in high demand. Kids over here see the posters and newsreels the same as anyone else. Around 10 o'clock or so, it was time for all the kids to go. But Susie found me again and took my hand and said, "Please, Sergeant, won't you write to me?" And what's a fella to say to that? I told her, "Every week, as long as you call me Bucky." And she "Every week, as long as you call me Bucky. As long as you call me Bucky. As long as you call me Bucky. Call me Bucky. Call me Bucky. Call me Bucky." That's it. And she smiled the way little girls are supposed to smile, in a time when her parents never got bombed by Jerry, and her only brother's not killed at Dunkirk. I got her address from the girl's minder, and I will write her, and maybe see if I can get Curly to write her too. It was very hard not to imagine Curly in Susie's place. Curly has all her brothers in the service too. And knowing that eventually we will be going back to France, there could well be another Dunkirk, couldn't there? It's awful to think about things like that, but even if I am off the line, it does not seem that going behind the line could be that much better for my prospects. February 16th. More bad news out of Anzio. The going is very tough for everyone we are hearing. I find myself reading about the 3rd Infantry with the thought that the 107th would have ended up in Italy regardless. Only we would have been assaulting Anzio instead of Salerno if we had never been transferred to the 36th. I suppose the worst thing a man can do is wonder what if about a war. At a certain point when you're in a foxhole getting shelled or about to go over the top hoping that your covering fire does its job, you realize that it is all chance anyway. One moment your buddy to your right is cut down, the next maybe it's you. What if does no good then, and it does no good now. Anyhow, here in London, and with Steve's bars, we do get a lot of news about the front. Dugan and Morta set a pint aside for the 15th IR. They were both in Charlie Company, but didn't know each other until Lozano, which is hard to imagine, seeing how they're in each other's pockets now. "I don't know about you fellows, but it's days like this, sitting around in a pub, that, grateful as I am to be off the front, I feel like shit for it," Dugan said, after we got to talking about the latest reports. It's strange that even though by rights the 3 of us should be home by now, even if for Morta that's California, and who would want to go there? And we are only still here because we are following Steve wherever he leads us. It still feels somehow like we're letting our men down by being here and not there. I did get a letter the other day from Chet. Poor Chernowitz. He was injured enough that it was not even a question of him being shipped home, but he needed 4 weeks in England before he could even punch his ticket. And now he is home. And though he did not say as much in the letter, it was mostly, "I heard from Castellano and Benson and so-and-so," it is clear how very lost he is without Frank Lorenzo, not to mention Ellis and Ball. I went to the park to watch kids play some ball, and saw that the corner shop window Frankie busted with a fly ball once was still boarded up. Chernowitz needed Abel looking after him, after Frankie. I can't help but worry he has no one at all looking after him now. He also addressed the letter Sarge. I will need to write him that considering we survived the Zahner together, and that he is now discharged, the least he can do is call me by my goddamn name.
Call me Bucky. Call me Bucky.
Yeah. February 17th. Leaving for another week of training Monday, so tonight all of us went to Rainbow Corner in Piccadilly. On account of neither Monty nor Dernier has ever been to America, and until we knock off Jerry, Rainbow Corner is the best we have. But in any case, with it so gray and dreary outside, us GIs are homesick as hell. Guys from all over the theater are there, some on their way home, or to other assignments, or just those here in London like we are, or close enough they can get to London by train. Anyway, with Steve drawing attention outside, we got Jones in with no trouble. And then once we were inside, all of us found a small room with a jukebox and billiards and darts, and Dugan ran up and got a mess of Cokes and donuts and burgers. Much better than the ones from Sicily. For all of us. And I swear we must have ate half the kitchen empty with how much we packed away. For myself, I am trying to plan ahead, assuming this training will offer as poor a diet as the last one. Steve eats more than any person I ever saw, and apparently more than anybody else has ever seen either. Captain, said Falsworth, when Steve had cleared off the burgers and was starting in on the waffles. God bless Rainbow Corner. You're going to lose that girlish figure at this rate. And Dugan says, shut the hell up, Monty. Cap's got the best goddamn tits in Uncle Sam's army. Steve nearly chokes on his waffle. I don't suppose the serum helps that. And we are all laughing, and Jones had been dozing a little, but he jumps awake, saying, tits? And Morta claps him on the shoulders. One day you'll understand, Jones. And I say, and here I thought Steve just liked wearing his Mae West under the uniform. And then Steve and Dugan snorted their Cokes out their noses at the same time. They were laughing so hard.
Mae West. Mae West.
February 19th. Awful bombing last night. We spent almost all of it in an air raid shelter, and though the conditions are very different, it is hard not to think you are in a foxhole getting shelled. The sounds are different, but the helplessness is the same. Steve hates it especially. How he has always loathed helplessness. To look at him, most would say his strength and size are what makes him exceptional. The truth is that it's just his body finally matches his will. But even he cannot do anything against bombers. We were in a shelter with dozens of others, including other Americans, who were the most upset about it. The Brits, meanwhile, appeared resigned to it. And why shouldn't they be? It has been their lot now for 3 years. Anyway, the initial reports on the BBC say that the bombing was very bad. On a train now to the thatched house, for training. I intend to write letters, and then sleep. It is easier on a train next to the fellas somehow. February 22nd. Next op is set. We are coordinating with the fellas in charge of F section, who are right bastards, if the last 2 days are anything to judge by. Because of some sort of artifact and its minder, are traveling on Goering's personal train to Paris, and it is our task to retrieve it. If you ever needed another reason to hate the fucking crowds, this is it. What kind of prick's got his own train? Agent Carter knows just about everyone in F section. It turns out that before she went on loan to OSS SSR, the reason the German doctor who worked on Steve was even in our hands, talk about giving somebody a piece of your mind if you could, is because in late 1940, Carter was in OSC and in theater. By herself, she got the doctor from Strasbourg to London. Honestly, sometimes I think somebody ought to call Ike. Who needs an invasion force when you got Carter? Just send her in and she'd have the war wrapped up in a week. Despite all that experience, she is not dropping with us. But she is not as miserable about it as I expected. I asked her why, and she gave me the sourest look I ever saw in a dame, and goes, use your head, Sergeant. I know too much. Meaning, if she's captured, her intel is too dangerous to go to enemy hands, and Jones looks at her like she's a goddamn second coming. Of course, that's how all of us look at her, I think. And goes, hell, I don't believe for 1 second you'd break. And we laugh a little, because it's true. I've known the woman 3 months, and if she got captured, I'd pity the Krauts, not her. But she didn't laugh at all. Instead, she shook her head and gave us all the severest look any of us ever received outside our own mothers, and goes, if there's one thing you all must know, and not only know but sincerely take to heart. It's this. It does not matter how strong one is, how smart one is, or how brave one is. With enough time, everyone will break. Jones stopped laughing straight away, and his expression went very bleak indeed. For me, I could feel Steve's eyes on me, considering how he found me at Asano. Hearing her say that made my stomach twist up something awful. I never even got asked questions. Not intel questions, anyway. And I lasted a couple of weeks. But I still wake up sometimes thinking I did break, and all of this is just a dream. And any second now, I will really wake up and be back there in that place. There is a lot in this war that makes me afraid, but outside of losing Steve, I am the most afraid of that, more even than getting killed. What they were doing, if it had kept going, I don't know if I could have lasted. You can't really remember pain, but you do remember fear. It sticks to your ribs and it doesn't go away. What's funny about it all is that tomorrow is training on what to do if we're captured. What a crock of shit. I think between the six of us, we have a handle on it. February 23rd. Mail. Curly wrote how she read an article in a magazine that says that there are billions of letters sent to GIs every year. If ever there was proof that the state of the world is unnatural, it is that. Men aren't meant to go so far from home, do and see terrible things for months and months. Families are not meant to be apart like this. I think of my letters from home like long, thin strings, piano wires, stretching from Brooklyn to here. And reading Ma's words is like she just plucked the string from her end, and I get an echo, just for an instant, before it fades away. Mostly I like imagining her writing them. She has her writing desk, which has moved with us from apartment to apartment since I can remember. Percolator on the stove, quilt of Mrs. Rogers that Steve gave her on her lap, looking out over the fire escape. And maybe it's snowing outside and everything is quiet, and she is thinking of me and Teddy and Jack, and how one day soon, surely soon, we will come home. How many times did I walk in the door to see her in that exact spot, dusty with flour, but she had a thought to write down or a letter to finish? To think how many mothers just like her, though not as sweet or as kind, how could they be, are doing the same thing, not just home but here in England and in France and in Russia. Even in Germany, dutifully writing letters to sons who may never get them, plucking those piano wires and endlessly waiting, just waiting for it to be plucked on the other end, thousands and thousands of miles away. Never in history has it been mothers who started a war. February 26th. What I want is Miss Kowalski's little potato dumplings that she used to make dozens of at a time and then invite practically the whole building. And Vini's challah, and Ms. Moore's fried apples and fried potatoes, and mashed potatoes and beans and turkey on Thanksgiving, and the maple candy from Rita's family store that they only ever had in summer. Frank's at the ballpark, and beers and shaved ice and hamburgers. Bagels and lox at Ma's cousin's bakery in Borough Park. God, I am hungry. February 28th. Going tonight. This is so much more complicated than anything we have done till now. And it is not the woods, or a remote island, but Paris. Paris, where they hung a goddamn swastika from the Eiffel Tower. And according to all the intel, Paris is dire. Hardly any food, everything rationed, Boche patrolling the streets. Some of the stories Agent Carter has from her friends there, and from all that goes on in 84 Avenue Foch, is enough to make a fella sick to his stomach. And in Steve's case, so angry he was about to jump in the channel and swim to Calais himself, perhaps with Dernier holding onto his ankle or something. Judging by the size of him these days, I wager it would be faster than a duck boat. It was a new moon a day or so ago, and cloud-covered at night, which seems to me the opposite conditions you'd want for a parachute drop, but they don't ask enlisted men these things, do they? In any case, the plan is to drop us northwest of Paris, and we are meeting several F-section assets who will provide us bicycles. It will be a ride that will take many hours,
It's March. I can only imagine the state of the roads, but we will get through somehow. Jones and Morta will be staying on with the racist thoughts to do their bit with the train, and so it will be just Steve, Dugan, Dernier, Mani, and myself going into Paris. Dernier is beside himself with joy. He has not been back since January 1941, when he was arrested and deported. He and Jones have been teaching us French. Steve is asking for things like, "Where are the Germans?" and "Help us." But me and Dugan just want to know what to say to French girls. Mani already speaks French, of course. Posh shit. Ought to be resting, but too keyed up to sleep. By now, it seems I should be over these combat nerves. But hearing from Agent Carter and Dernier what the inside of 84 Avenue Foch is like keeps playing in my head like a minute newsreel over and over. Here we go again. Avenue Foch. Gestapo headquarters in Paris, where hundreds and even thousands of suspected members of the French resistance were interrogated and tortured. Sarge, you still at this? Take a break before you lose it. Already dead.